17th.
Today is what, November 17th, 1999, and we're with G.C. Blackburn, and please tell me what the G and the C stand for.
Gardner Clark Blackburn.
Okay, great.
Full name. I don't use it, but...
People knew you as G.C.?
G.C. Part of the time I was called Blackie.
Okay.
I worked on the Mississippi River on the dams, and I used to work for a... When I was a regular carpenter, I worked for a boss. They called him Whitey, because I was Whitey before. So then they called him Whitey. I had to be called Blackie.
And why did they call you Whitey?
I don't know about
Just the opposite of Blackie?
My hair was always light.
Okay.
Light color. I guess that's probably why.
What projects were you working on in the Mississippi?
Well, I worked on two different dams as a carpenter. And then I worked for DuPont. We built a plant in Iowa, and that's why I knew. And of course, DuPont was the same thing down in Oklahoma. I worked down in Oklahoma there on that. Well, we were making stuff for the war.
And you were working for DuPont at
yes,
that point,
yes.
And doing construction.
Right.
Okay.
And there, I was sort of a layout carpenter down there. I didn't have to go out in the mud and water.
Okay.
I worked out of the main building.
So where were you in 1943 when DuPont wanted to send you out here?
When they found me, I was business agent for the carpenters in
Were you working on a project?
No, I had a regular office and everything.
Oh, okay.
When I got a call from Oklahoma job from my business agent in Savannah, Illinois, wanting to know if I wanted his job. And I said, well, it's close to home, my family's here and everything. So I quit that job and come back up there. And he retired. And I got elected by full vote. So I was there about 2 years or so, maybe three. And this recruiter come along for this job out here. And he said, I'm looking for carpenters. He said, and by the way, maybe you want to go out. And I said, well, I would if I was a foreman, but not as a carpenter. So he said, well, we need foreman too. And so I had three carpenters that come out with me. And I drove out here from there. I didn't ever, it was in the West like this before. You know. And we got out here. And
about what time was that, in October?
That was about the last... In the last 3 days of October, I think it was.
And you said you had a family, but they were still back?
They were still back there because I had bought a house in Savannah.
Savannah, Illinois.
Yeah.
Okay.
So they stayed there and I come out here. And the first thing they said to me when I got to the office the next morning was I'd have to work at my tools for a week before I could.
Yeah.
And I said, well, who's the manager? And they told me, I said, well, by God, I know him. I better go see him. I went and seen him. He shook hands and he said he was a top dog at the Oklahoma job when I was there. So he knew me from there. And I told him, I said, somebody's wanting me to work with my tools. He said, you don't have to work with your tools. You've been in DuPont too long. You know all their safeties and all that.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember his name?
I can't. There's a lot of names I can't remember. Anymore.
What was he in charge of at Hanford?
All the carpenter work.
Oh, okay.
All the carpenter construction. Yeah.
Okay. So instead of picking up your tools, you were a foreman?
I was a foreman right off the bat. They gave me about 15 guys and three or four helpers. And the first day, I worked right in Hanford. We was building the places to eat and stuff like that, you know.
In the construction camp.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And before the day was out, a guy come around to me and said, "I understand that you're a heavy construction worker." I said, "Yes, oh, that's all I knew more of that, and I did this kind of work." So he said, "You pick out about five of your best men, and tomorrow morning hit the bus to the area, west area." So I did, and I got out there, and they had me another 15 carteners, 20 carteners, and about eight helpers. And tea plant was just a big hole in the ground.
Okay.
A big hole in the ground.
Had they even started pouring concrete yet?
Seems to me that there had been a little concrete poured in the basement and stuff.
I think one of the things I read was that they started it well before then, but
yeah,
very little work was done because the reactors were getting a lot of the
they were
materials
getting attention.
Yeah.
Also, they were making the blueprints in Chicago, and we got new blueprints about every day. For the
revised or just more of them?
Some of them revised, some of them more of them. As we went along, that's the way it worked.
But every day, did you have some specific part of the project where there were blueprints and it was laid out?
I was farming over the 224 and 221 both.
Okay.
Carpenter crews. There was probably about five at that time in the big plant. There was about five or maybe four carpenter foremen, and each one of them had a crew there. So we put that building up pretty fast.
And I guess was a lot of the work just doing concrete forming?
Most of it was forming and stuff. And like I said about our blueprints, where they had the blueprints all in a little house, and we could come in, the foreman could come in there and get out the blueprint and take measurements and all that different stuff and put that on a piece of paper and go out again, but we couldn't take the blueprints out of them.
How many times a day would you have to go back in there?
Oh, about twice, I guess.
That's all?
At noon and morning and noon.
And you were able to take enough notes?
Oh, yes. That's always.
How is that different from a regular job? How might you deal with blueprints on a regular job?
Well, we could carry the blueprints on when I worked in Oklahoma and stuff like that.
Wouldn't you be referring to them many, many times a day?
It's probably quite a bit.
Yeah, well,
especially on some certain jobs.
So how were you able at Hanford just to look at this huge satellite twice a day?
It was such a large job.
Oh,
and
so, okay.
And when you put in one deal for concrete, why, it took piles of concrete to fill that up. You know, it was like...
So if you were said, we have to make this set of forms this morning, it might be 500 feet long or something like that.
We made an awful big plant.
Uh-huh.
And used big rigs. And the same time we were building that one, we were building the 224.
Mm-hmm.
And I had men in each place.
And what did they tell you the building was going to be?
Nothing. That time, all we had to do was guess, because we had so much concrete that... See,
you were starting to get a feel for how big it was?
Oh, yeah. Jeez, it was a big one. And I knew it had to be some explosive, but I didn't know what kind.
It was DuPont, and it was the war.
Yeah. See, I was a carpenter on a plant in Savannah. It's about 6 miles out of Savannah, where we made the regular bombs and everything like that. So I got to see how they were made and packed and painted and everything like that pretty well, because I was up there during that time.
Were you surprised at how thick the walls were?
Oh, God, yes. On the dams, we'd had walls a foot and a half, 2 feet thick. and got out here and run into 6 foot, 7 foot walls, so I knew something had to be an explosive. But they, we never said anything. We didn't dare tell our families or anything like that what was going on.
When you were forming up, say, walls, and you started from the bottom and you realized they were 7 feet thick, did you form them all the way up, or what was the work?
Well, you form one set about around 18 foot high, and then you poured concrete there, and then you went you pulled in vans up, and you go up, keep going up.
And the rebar would continue on up?
Oh, yes. That's right.
So you started well below grade then, right?
Oh, it was right. Big hole. Mm-hmm. Big hole. Yeah, that, I'm just guess from now that the hole itself was 35, 40 foot deep. I don't know. It was pretty hot. They put a good deal in the bottom of it. Because that had to be deep concrete underneath the cells and everything, mm-hmm. you know, and the cells are all down under the ground.
Were they calling them cells at the time when you were forming up all these compartments?
I don't know what we called them, tell you the truth about it.
Because it, on the one hand, it makes it real easy if everybody refers to everything in the same way, but if they're not allowed to tell you what the real name is, then everybody might end up using a different name.
Using everything.
Yeah.
That's right.
So you were working with rebar inside the walls, but at some point as you got up, there was a lot of piping too.
Oh, yes.
And were you dealing with that with your forming?
Carpenters didn't deal with the piping. There were piping people that was putting in there before we poured concrete.
But who was cutting holes in the form and making sure the holes were in the...
We cut holes in the forms and stuff.
Was that pretty straight?
Some of the same forms we could use for a lot of different... A lot of different cells. See, really, 221 was built, well, in a way, a little bit sloppy, but it was, each cell was pretty much the same as the other, until you got down to the where we brought in the metal and stuff like that.
Those
dollars and stuff like that down there. And then, of course, we had to build the track. The tracks come in
for the train?
Yeah, I guess it would be called the East End. East End of Teepland, I guess. That the tanks and a lot of all the equipment practically come into the deal through the railroad and through the where we put the dissolvers afterwards. These are big tanks.
Yeah.
There was no way of putting them in through the doors. I had two guys for several months. All they done is build the entrance to the canyon. And after the first ones using the blueprint, so after that we didn't need the blueprint, we knew just what they were doing.
Really?
They're all the same, and every along about every 100 feet I would put an entry into the, and the entry was the level at the top of the cells.
Mm-hmm.
So everything from there was down under the grounds.
And the entries you're talking about were on the smokestack side of the building that went into the canyon itself?
The entries were all on the, let's see, that was east. That'd be on the south side. South side.
Southeast side?
South, yeah, of the canyon.
Okay.
The whole length.
And on the other side of the canyon, well, the long side, that was the gallery side.
That's where the galleries were.
And they had their own entrances.
We had the offices and all that on that side. Yeah.
On the entrances that went into the canyon, could you describe, do you remember how those were built up?
Well, we started out like this. We put steps up to here, and then we put steps this way, and then we put steps into the canyon. And that's where the doors were.
And those were also thick walls.
So that anything from inside would not affect you outside at all, couldn't it, the radiation or anything.
Was the door anything special? Did you ever see the door? Were you around for that?
Them doors is just heavy wood and
okay.
stuff like that. They were thick and mm-hmm. heavy.
Okay.
I remember that. We had to put it.
Back to the building of the forms for a 7-foot wall is
yeah.
in itself no big deal. But do you remember how precise they asked you to make the forming?
Oh, the forming had to do they wanted it, you know, just as close as possible. See, the forms inside, and then they made all the covers for the cells outside.
Right.
That was a different game.
I've seen pictures of that.
And they were,
but you were forming up the cells themselves?
Oh yes, on the cells themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And we had to have them just almost perfect, according to the engineers, in order for these big tops to fit in just right, see.
As a matter of comparison, what were your tolerances on other jobs for DuPont when you're just building a normal chemical factory?
Well, probably half, 3/4 of an inch on a lot of work.
Okay.
But this one here, we tried to be with underneath a 1/2 inch.
And when you were forming the cells, did they have metal forms or pre-made forms?
We had pre-made forms that stuck in there. I can't remember what they were made out of.
Mm-hmm.
I think they were metal.
And those had the holes for all?
We used them in every cell, the same ones, just moved on down the cells.
Did they have the holes for all the fittings that came into the cells?
Yeah, that was, there we'd put in plugs, what we call plugs. And they had to go through the concrete because, and some of them come from the other cells and some of them come in there like and up where we added chemicals and stuff
mm-hmm.
down through there and electrical deals to put electric lines and like that, a lot of that stuff in there.
Were you there when they poured concrete?
Oh yes.
Yeah. So you were there building the forms and taking the forms down later on?
At the same time, most of the forms, like I said, when they poured up to this level, why then you just pulled the forms up with the big trains
there. Mm-hmm.
And we used some of the same bolts that we used to get the bottoms in, and we used the same thing up top.
The cells were what, 20 feet deep, something like that, plus the thickness of the covers. They were very deep.
The cells were all at least 20 foot deep.
And did you didn't pour those in one pour then, that depth? I was wondering how you used those reusable forms.
Some of the forms was pulled up inside too. But I think they were pouring 15 to 20, almost 20 foot of concrete. We had a big machine set up for concrete. You didn't bring trucks in. The trucks just put it into the big machines, and the machines come and we poured concrete. It was just a steady stream.
It was pumped in.
Yeah, pumped in.
Mm-hmm.
And fellows worked in there and with what we used to call
to tamp down the concrete?
Yeah.
Were they vibrators?
Well, that's what they were, mm-hmm. but we had names for it. You know.
How did you stick a vibrator down into a 7-foot thick wall that was just packed full of piping and conduit and stuff like that?
Well, you could do that. We used both kinds. One vibrator was about that big.
That 3 inches across?
Well, not quite three.
Okay.
Probably 3.5 and long, about like that. You
mm-hmm.
know.
2 feet.
And then we had what we called a pineapple that roared and, when you put it in concrete, and it just, there's it all over. I had both kinds.
And if any of those pipes had been bumped or knocked or dislodged,
well,
would have been real trouble. Was everybody extra careful, or was it in there?
I'm sure that was. We didn't seem to have any problem
okay.
that way. See, a lot of the pipes themselves, if I remember right, we put in what we call jockeys for these holes, and then the pipes was put in some of them afterwards.
Oh.
They weren't always
through channels,
you know,
in the concrete.
That's right.
Oh.
Huh. And then that afterwards they put these heads on these lines so that the crane could bring in a pipe, all different rods, and put it onto there and then tighten it up.
Mm-hmm. I've seen pictures.
Our biggest problem was the gaskets. When they start leaking, you had to pull off that jumper. We called them jumpers. Mm-hmm. You had to pull them off and put in a new one because they would be too hot. Some of them would be too hot. If they were chemical jumpers, you could bring them out and redo the deal. But the whole system for 221T was very simple. Very simple. All we did is bring in the slugs and take the aluminum coats off that we had put on in 300 area. I worked a few weeks in 300 area also on making them slugs before I was chosen to go out to 231 building.
Is that where you first met Roger Hultgren?
Hultgren, I believe I didn't meet him until I got up to 221 to operate for Oshawa.
Okay.
See, some of them guys didn't come out during construction. I think they come more or less when it was about ready to start up.
Right.
I think he come from Chicago too, I believe.
Yeah.
Remember. But I knew him well. He knew me.
Well, let's maybe change gears for a minute. Let's jump to the end of construction.
Yeah.
And did you leave 221 after it was completely finished?
Practically.
You stuck with it
yeah.
most of the time?
Well, yeah, I worked till almost October. October.
Of 44?
Yeah. And then my whole crew was laid off. In fact, we had that part all done, and then 24 was done. So that was my deal. So they talked about our whole crew was going to be laid off. Well, I decided I maybe I'd go into operations. And so I signed up for operation, but most of my men all went home. They went back to Illinois and
really?
Different places like that where we come from.
Because there wasn't any work on the rest of the site because it was getting finished
well,
up too?
It was, they were finishing up on the other plant right down below that was supposed to do the same thing the T plant.
That was
U plant.
Yeah.
They never did.
Mm-hmm.
They never operated that. Later on, they used that for uranium.
The recycling.
One on T plant wasn't made for uranium at all. All we did is cook stuff up, put it in the tanks, wash it with different chemicals, and then let it settle. And the uranium went down and plutonium come up. Then we sucked the plutonium off and moved it on and set the uranium to the big tanks.
Yep.
That's the way we did that. And we just did that after several, and each time we had the plutonium down to smaller and smaller And then we just sent it across to 224. Mm-hmm. And there they made it smaller and cleaner and smaller and cleaner. And each batch ended up about three gallons or 3.5 gallons. And we put them in 5 gallons stainless steel. I forget what we called them now. And that's the way we transferred them to 231 building. Put them in big deals that we had.
So when in October of 44,
yeah,
the construction was winding down, when they sent you to the 300 area?
That's when I hired out for operations. I went through all the dope, and I had my clearances and everything anyway, but everybody went through 300 area while they rechecked your clearances and everything. Even though I had clearances for practically everything in construction, they still needed more clearances and about your life and all this and that. So they sent you to 300 area for a week or so. The first few couple of days, you didn't even get in where the slugs were. You waited till they okayed you.
And when you went from construction into operations, what did you think you were going into?
When I got into there, I still didn't know what the slugs was for.
Uh-huh.
But I knew that where they were going. I knew they were going to the reactors.
Did you know they were reactors, or you just knew they were plants?
I think they called them plants or something at that time.
Okay.
But we took the uranium and made slugs about 8 inches long, about 1.25 inches through, mm-hmm. and had them up to 1,400-1,500 degrees, and then we shook them up there for so long. We had clocks, and then when that was ready, we transferred them over into the aluminum. Aluminum was terribly hot too, and we had these shields, aluminum shields, a little bit longer than the slug was. And that was in this stuff. We pushed that thing down in there, and then we had a cap. We capped it off with it and brought it out, cooled it all down, and then welded the cap with a welder.
How many slugs at a time would you be dealing with? In any given hour, how many slugs went through your hands?
We put on a shift, let's see, I think that we were running 200 on a shift, if I remember right. Each shift kept track of what they were
shift running. Being maybe 8, 9, 10 hours?
8 hours, yeah, 8-hour shifts. Yeah, and three shifts around the clock, yeah. And then we put them all in a carriers, and that's the way they were sent to the reactors.
So in October of 44, the first reactor had already started up.
Oh yeah.
Okay. So your slugs were needed very much so to keep it going.
We were still making the full length slugs with the new pipes. You know, the pipes afterwards got messed up in the reactors. Then they started making small. I didn't, not while I was there, but afterwards they had to make these slugs smaller, so they got around the.
Mm-hmm. The graphite in the reactors was expanding.
I was about a month in 300 area, and I was picked to go to 231 because they were just getting some material to 231. Plutonium, and I was picked as chief operator, and I was the first chief operator made in 300 or 321.
The 331?
331 building.
Wait, 231.
231.
Yeah.
Now you got it.
And that was the, went from the 221 building, the big building, to the 224.
To 231.
And from 221 to 224, it was piped over?
Yes.
And how was it?
We pumped it.
And how'd you get it to the 231?
With trucks.
You put it in a container and carried it over?
Container, and then went with the trucks. And so then I went down there, and we had two cells down there. And I was chief on both, and had about three operators in each cell. And everything was into glass deals, cells down there, you know. Mm-hmm. We put it in and drop it, pick it up, drop it, clean it. And
so you didn't have to be a chemist to do the job. You had to be able to follow the procedures.
No, we had chemists in the building.
So in a sense, you were like a foreman,
managing
the actual process.
That's what I think a chief is supposed to be for.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
He takes care of the help. And then he had the manager of 231, and he had a supervisor, too. And
did you know what you were doing?
That was the end of Side B. Time for new tape.
Okay, still November 17th. Mr. Blackburn. And testing, testing, testing. 1, 2, 3, 4. 1, 2. Okay, it seems to be running. The light is on. Describe again then about the dissolver. You said you didn't have to empty it between batches.
You never did. You always leave the bunch in the bottom of it.
I heard the word heel used.
Well,
does that ring a bell?
Yes.
Where they'd leave something in there?
Yeah, we always left something.
What was the idea of leaving something in there instead of just finishing one whole batch and emptying it out?
I don't know why that was. That was, we always left the slugs in there.
And with the first dissolving was to get the aluminum off.
That's the first thing you did, yeah.
And that was like a sodium hydroxide or...
Seemed like we used...
It was like a lye almost?
I thought we used a sulfuric. I'm not sure.
And would you leave it in the same dissolver for the next step? Or would you...
No. You jetted the jackets. You jetted that off to the waste.
Out of the dissolver?
Yeah.
Okay.
You had to get that out.
And what was left was more or less bare aluminum slugs? Uranium slugs?
Uranium slugs. Okay. Just same, almost the same as they were when they left 300 areas.
Did you wash them in water or anything in between?
No.
Okay. Just got rid of the waste?
As I know, we just took this 60%, I think we used 60% acid and dissolved them.
And once it was dissolved, then you had material to work with.
Yeah, okay. And it never dissolved them all. It just dissolved the top, you might say. And that's what we jetted into holding tanks.
Could you explain how those jets worked? They weren't pumps, right?
Some places we used pumps, but most of the places, you got a suction line, and you got a jet here with a certain deal, and you run the steam through that, and when that steam runs through that, it sucks your material right with it.
Did it add steam to the material?
Oh, yes.
Okay.
Oh, yes.
So you had to factor that in?
You had to factor that in because that was part of your sluicing afterwards. Mm-hmm. The more steam you use, the more liquid you come up with.
How effective was that as a pump? Did it work pretty well?
A jet is wonderful.
Yeah.
Yep. Jet is wonderful.
No moving parts?
No moving. It just sits right there and you run the steam through your deal.
And basically, you could only, I guess, pump so high because you're working on a vacuum principle. You're sucking it out.
You're just sucking it right out of there.
Okay. Another issue was the dissolvers was where the really dangerous gases were let off. That was sort of the most toxic part of the process.
Probably.
And they ran the exhaust directly out from there to the stack.
Went to a stack. Of course, all the cells were all made to go.
I was under the impression that the dissolvers had their own special vent pipes.
They could have.
Yeah, okay.
They could have.
Were you also watching what was coming out of the stack during the
dissolvers?
Was that your job or was it somebody else's?
Not necessarily my job, no. We had people that worked in maintenance. I was supposed to watch some of that kind of stuff.
How about the weather report before you were allowed to dissolve?
Right.
How did that come to you? You know, you knew there was going to be a batch coming in.
They had their own weather station at Hanford. Every night they sent up a balloon and stuff like that to give directions and things like that. And we got all our deal right from the...
And what would you do if they said the weather's going to be bad for 2 days?
We didn't do it.
What'd you do?
We just didn't. Well, we could move material.
The process that we're still going.
To dissolve.
Okay. Was there ever like a 10-day period when you weren't allowed to dissolve?
I didn't think quite that long that I could remember. But there was a lot of days that you couldn't dissolve.
But it didn't mean you sat around drinking coffee.
No, no.
Yeah.
We still operated the rest of the building.
Okay.
Yeah.
And the building never did, you never had to wait so long that the building had no processes going on?
No.
Yeah, okay.
There was, I was thinking there was some times when we used to flush tanks, clean a tank out completely, and bring the metal in and... So we didn't dissolve every day.
Mm-hmm. Did the crane operator do a lot of inspections to see that things were okay? How did you know that things weren't leaking or that rusting out?
We had things in our sumps and had deals showing if we had a leak in a cell, a sump told us that we had it. He didn't have to worry about that until we told him.
But was that one cell, the sewer cell that was real deep? Or the collection cell? It was like 20 feet deeper than the rest?
It was a big cell anyway, because there was a lot of stuff put in that.
And where would the stuff come from that went into that?
From the rest of the building.
It wasn't from the tanks, it was from spills and things like that?
It was what we call connectors. It was connectors for stuff that we was transferring from one cell, from one tank to another and from another cell into that.
Mm-hmm.
And if we got a leak, we stopped it immediately when we got a signal.
Right.
And then the crane operator went and inspected.
When you say the connectors,
you tighten it up.
Where the connector met the wall of the cell, that joint might leak.
Right.
And liquid would go down onto the cell floor.
Right down into the sump.
And a drain that went all the way down.
We always had sumps in every cell.
And was there a drain from that sump down to that sewer cell?
I believe that we were able to jet a sump out of it into a tank.
Oh, your discretion?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. That was the only way we did it.
The normal waste, the uranium waste, was sent out in a pipe all the way.
Yeah, that was, went right down to the...
And only if that pipe leaked would anything end up in the cell itself. The cells were to remain dry at all times if possible.
Supposedly.
Yeah.
Supposedly.
Okay. And did you hose down the cell if there was a leak?
We were hosed.
Okay.
We were hosed.
Did guys do it or did the crane operator do it?
if I remember right, the crane operator down to the...
He put a hose on his... That's great.
See, at that time, we couldn't fool around re-gasketing anything. They didn't know how, I guess, to re-gasket. When I got the Purex, we were able to re-gasket a lot of stuff. I don't know why, but the guys could do it.
I could see either way, because taking off a gasket and putting one on doesn't sound difficult, but it depends, I guess.
This is depends on at T plant. We didn't think you could do that.
Do you remember near the end of construction, the T plant, when they had to go through and replace a lot of gaskets before the plant started up?
I'm sure they did that.
Supposedly they were using Teflon gaskets.
The wrong gaskets or something.
And when the impact wrench tightened them down, it was too much for them.
Yeah.
So they went to a different kind of gasket.
About that, I didn't see any.
Yeah. Yeah. Interesting. Well, my throat's getting dry. Maybe we're about done. You must be feeling fatigued too.
I'm talking.
And that's the end of the Gardner Blackburn interview.